Can I take this tender? This is a nice tender. All right, thank you very much to the shul for hosting the winter baby draft. Wonderfully hospitable. And thank you to the fellows of the winter baby draft who have extraordinary stamina in listening and learning all day. Really quite remarkable. I have a couple of thanks that I want to give before I start. This year, to a group of people who helped me work on the topic of competition law and halakha. But first, Drs. Martin Gaynor and Ted Rosenbaum, who are professional competition economic analysts, who were generous enough to both come this summer to the summer Beit Midrash when I dealt with this topic, and to spend time with me as well, trying to teach me the basics of the economics that were necessary for this. Professor Chaim Seyman, who also came and gave a guest lecture and taught me about the difference between front and back end regulation, which was a really useful concept. And Mr. Mark Katz, who's a competition lawyer in Toronto, who came in and gave a presentation on what he does in his law practice, which was also tremendously helpful, as well as various halakhic writers, specifically Rabbi Chaim Jaffe. Okay. Topic I want to talk about tonight, topic I gave was, why does halakha regulate competition? And I want to make clear that the title is different than how does halakha regulate competition. Because it would be possible, if you want to give a shiur on how does halakha regulate competition, so what you do is you take all the existing sources and you try and create a pattern. You try and create a pattern out of them, and you treat it as sort of a positive law where you just want to know what does the law say, as opposed to trying to figure out what is the law trying to accomplish. Right. I want to start by asking the question, why is there a body of law governing competition in halakha? Now that is part of a much broader question, which is it useful generally in the context of law to ask the question, biblical law, let's say, halakha d'oraita, is it useful to ask the question, why is there a law as this? Right. Probably many of you know that this is a topic of some controversy. There is what purports to be a machloket in the Gemara about whether we say darshinan tamad dekra or lo darshinan tamad dekra, which the Gemara in Bava Metzia and Sanhedrin and various other places, at least Bava Metzia and Sanhedrin sets it up as a machloket, a dispute between Rabbi Huda and Rabbi Shimon, in which if you take it, it seems like Rabbi Shimon takes the position that rationales are useful in terms of the law, and Rabbi Huda takes the position that you just take biblical law as it is, you don't think about why when you're creating new law. Now, I tend to take the position that we rule like Rabbi Shimon, and that actually the other position is impossible, that no legal system can develop without thinking about rationales. Because whenever a new case comes up, which there isn't a dispositive textual evidence, the only way you can resolve an open case is by thinking about why. But even though I take that position generally, so I acknowledge that at least in theory that position is controversial. But there's a reason that the law, that competition law is different, even though it is biblical law. And the reason is that even though biblical halakha competition law has the status of halakha d'oraita, it actually has no biblical source at all. So, right, who knows what the conventional term for halakha competition law is? Hasagat gvul. So I gave you the first source on your sheet. The Shulchan Aruch. Right, the Shulchan Aruch, Choshen Mishpat, page 376, Laws of Robbery. And these are the laws regarding one who infringes the boundary of his fear, which is a literal translation of...
We have another one up here. Right.
Literal translation of Hasagat Gvul. And you'll see that, astonishingly enough, the laws about infringing boundaries cover the laws of infringing boundaries. Nothing whatsoever about competition. There's a little note on the bottom, which says, if you want to... Right, as to whether you're allowed to take his fellow's marufya, which we'll talk about in a moment, which is the classic case of the competition law, you'll have to look somewhere else. Because actually, the term hasagat gvul, as applied to competition law, is purely a literary flourish. Right, the only conceivable biblical source for the laws of competition is the principle that you are supposed to do the good and the right, and the good and the straight in the eyes of God. Vasit ha-tov ha-yashar. Which is all very nice and good, but doesn't give me any direct information as to what I'm supposed to do this. It might just tell me that the reason that we regulate competition law is to do the right and the good. Okay, so that's my first premise I want to set out, is that there is no biblical source for halakhic competition law, and that means that we cannot resort to saying that God said it so we can't think about it. It means that the law has to have a rational, humanly discoverable purpose. And therefore we have to ask the question, why? Or we don't understand what's happening. Okay, so now I want to ask a second order question. What are the two kinds of answers you could give to the question, why does halakha regulate competition?
Social good.
Social good, or?
And darkei shalom.
And darkei shalom. So what's the difference between social good and darkei shalom?
One is an abstract, and darkei shalom is something that's real. In other words, you can tell what is darkei shalom.
I would argue that the public good is not abstract at all in this case, and that darkei shalom is because it deals with fairness to everybody.
So I think this is like, there's a mission in Rosh Hashanah, which records a statement. There's a statement where the Talmud says, you blow the shofar on Shabbat Rosh Hashanah in every Beit Din, and then Rabbi Eliezer says, really, every Beit Din? No, only the Beit Din Yavne. And they respond, they say, no, Yavne is no different than any other Beit Din. And the Talmud says, what's the difference between saying every Beit Din and in Yavne and every other Beit Din? And it gives an answer, but the problem is no one can tell which answer applies to which one. Right? So we claim there's a difference, so that's, I think, where we are here, right? Actually, I think social good and darkei shalom, since you can each explain them in opposite ways, probably the words aren't going to help us. Dramatically. Yes, go ahead.
It's probably not going two ways, but you could say it's to benefit consumers, uh-huh, benefit businesses.
Okay, so now I want to take that, and I want to oppose it. I'm sorry, I don't know your name?
Marty.
Okay. And so what Marty and Ivan said, I want to oppose it. I want to oppose what you said, and to really, collectively, right, your answers, right, are the two categories I want. Because one is, you can do it because you're trying to regulate economics as economics. Right? I mean, that's your issue, right? This is a form of economic regulation that has economic purposes. And the second is that it's a form of moral regulation which has interests other than economic. Right? So we see this as a method, as a method designed for the practical regulation of the, right, of the market? Or do we see them as ways of saying, well, you know, the market would be, right, if we were just interested in, right, in maximizing the efficiency of the market, we would do this, but we have moral issues in addition. So what I want to suggest is that usually the way in which the halakhot of Hasagat Gvul are presented is that there's a given that society, that markets, usually it's a free market assumption. That really, right, that halakhic regulation, we start off with a suspicion of halakhic regulation. We say it's probably going to decrease efficiency. So we see it as a moral superstructure. Right? There's the market, and the market is designed to maximize certain kinds of economically defined goods. And then after that, along comes halakha and says, you shouldn't always take all the profit that you can. Right? I think that's the conventional presentation of Hilchot HaSagat. We're not looking to halakha to tell us how to regulate economies. That we would look to economics for. The only reason what halakha can contribute is the possibility there should be restraints on maximal efficiency. Yes, you're looking at me sort of puzzled. No,
no.
Okay. No. Okay. Okay. I'll learn to look over time. The way I want to address that issue is as follows. The presumption of that type of approach is that the economy will be regulated ideally, and then halakha comes. And that assumes that halakha always exists in the context of other economic regulations, unless you think that the most efficient market is a wholly unregulated market. Right? But if you think that any degree of regulation and social control is necessary in order to promote the economic good, Right? So then in order to claim that halakha is just a moral overlay on an economic structure, you have to claim that halakha always exists in the context of a different economic structure. And that, I think, is a presumption that is generated by the reality of modernity, where halakha is never given the authority to regulate the economy directly, and therefore it's plausible to say that we always look at halakha as an add-on. But if you look at halakha from its self-perception, halakha's self-perception is that it is the legal system, and so if halakha, whatever regulations there are in a halakhic state, are halakhic. So if halakha wishes to take responsibility for an economy, then it has to handle the economic regulations as well as the moral regulations. And then I think, you know, this was something that I sort of knew, but it was brought home to me in the conversations with the various people I spoke to preparing for last summer, that really, it does not seem as if the current position is that an unregulated market is ideal. And in fact, if we talk about what the purpose of competition law is, for example, in the United States, the purpose of a competition law is not to restrain competition. The purpose of antitrust law is to regulate competition so as to preserve it.
It's actually unfair competition.
Yes, right, because an unregulated market will lead to monopolies. And the goal of antitrust legislation is to maximize, it's to create an efficient market, by preserving competition.
Except where they want monopolies.
Yes, right. We can all talk about what the, and Canada, right, Canada, in order to make that point, apparently Canada calls its sphere competition law as opposed to antitrust law, whereas the United States refers to it as antitrust law, and Mr. Katz wanted to argue that was that was deliberate and reflective priorities. But, yes?
Are you okay with questions in the middle, interrupting?
Yeah, I'm fine. Also, it looks like we're not going to, it's not a very big outline, so I'm counting on people.
So just to make sure I understand the second way of looking at it, where halakha views itself as encompassing the totality of all laws, including market regulations. So I have no idea where this is in the Gemara, but I'm pretty sure that somewhere there are stories about Amoraim or Tanaim who go out and actually regulate the prices in the market. They say, wheat is too expensive, we're going to lower the price.
Yes.
Or vice versa. So do you think that under the second approach, that is a psak din?
Yes. But I think that you have different mechanisms for making law. You have legislation, right? And then you have particular, right? You have particular officials with discretion. Right? Those are examples of officials with discretion. And you have various attempts at price regulation in the Gemara. And we'll even talk about one of them as well. Yes.
Well, there are examples where psak din actually creates an ecclesiastical imperative to behave a certain way based on an issue that would be viewed as competitive. For example, if in a town there is a butcher, and a butcher from the next town wants to sell meat there, the rabbi, the Beis Din, can refer to that meat coming from the outside as unkosher. And in fact, it is viewed by halacha as unkosher.
So you're about six lines ahead in my outline. I'm not sure I'm going to agree with you at the end, but that's where we are. But I assure you we'll get there. Excellent, yeah.
Today at Mincha, you asked people which areas of the halachot from Chosh and Mishpat apply in their lives.
Yeah.
And yet, one of the main examples that you discussed was the question of charging interest on loans, the prohibition on ribis, which is in your Idea.
Yes.
The question of moral overlay and economic law, perhaps their sides being taken even within laws which some of us might choose one way or the other would fall into one of those categories. The halakhic tradition may see otherwise. Your Idea is more about moral religious prohibitions rather than monetary.
Okay, yes. You were the one who pointed out after Mincha? Yes, you did, right? You were the one who pointed out. Somebody pointed out to me after Mincha that I read that it was a bad example to use, right, to use ribbis because ribbis is in Yerodea. Whether the placement of ribbis in Yerodea is a statement about ribbis being, right, not being economic legislation as opposed to, right, having moral interest as well. Interesting point. Okay. I don't want to claim it's either or. I want to claim there are two possibilities that we tend to think of it as one, Right? We tend to think of halakhic competition law as a moral overlay and not as the fundamental structure of the market. I don't think that's the only way you have to think about it. Right? I want to argue for the validity of thinking it the other way, but then I'll try and complicate that so we'll end up with both. Right? I think it's a false dichotomy, but it's useful to introduce a dichotomy so that you can get to the ultimate synthesis or whatever fancy term you want to use. Blend, whatever, synthesis, too fancy, it's not really what I want. Not a dialectical tension. Okay. So I think that people almost always present halakhic competition law in the terms that, is it okay if I call you by first name? Yeah, okay, sorry, I don't want to make distinctions, I don't know other people's titles.
This is the academy.
Okay. People usually make distinctions, assume that the classic examples of halakha are places where we protect one person from competition by another. Right? We protect an existing merchant from competition by another person. And it seems like that's intended to preserve monopoly. And therefore, we assume that the purpose of halakha is not any kind of economic efficiency, but rather the preservation of the interest of the person in the status quo. So I want to just point out theoretically.
That's actually not true.
Yeah.
As I was saying before,
yeah.
In certain cases, it is the public good to have a monopoly for the electric company.
Exactly right.
Or whatever it is. So there is. It's not that
clear. Absolutely. Therefore, I want to say that we have to be careful about making it right as to whether that is actually the paradigm for all of halakhic competition law. Maybe that shows, at most, that shows that among the interests of halakha, in certain cases, is preserving certain kinds of very carefully defined local monopolies. But it may be that other aspects of halakha are intended to preserve competition and prevent unfair competition. As it happens, there is, in fact, a Mishnah which is precisely about preserving competition, which is talking about the question of whether storekeepers are allowed to distribute candies to children, or is that unfair marketing practices because you're getting the children to come to you for other matters which are unrelated. Rabbi Yehuda says that a merchant is not allowed to do that. The sages disagree and say, why not? And then the Talmud concludes the reason the sages say that is because that's not, even though it's irrelevant competition, it's not unfair competition because you can just distribute greater sweets. And then we can talk about that, not necessarily. Maybe you're talking about somebody who has greater cash reserves. It is right. You know, can we distinguish between distinguishing between predatory pricing and discounting? All those sorts of issues can come up. So I think that there certainly are grounds, you know, prima facie grounds for arguing that halakha has both interests in mind, which it should, if it is about setting the structure of a market as opposed to merely imposing additional moral constraints. Okay, so I want to set up as the really what is the paradigm of competition law as halakha develops over the years, which is why the Shulchan Aruch when it talks about Hasagat Gevul, the Shulchan Aruch says, and if you want the laws of Marufya, look somewhere else. Now, why does he do that? Because the classic example of Hasagat Gevul for the Shulchan Aruch, he knows perfectly well, is Marufya. So we have to find out what really is the law about Marufya. So Marufya was a medieval concept, which was that if a Jew developed an economic relationship with a local wealthy Gentile, you became the court Jew. And that basically meant you handled all their banking, all their finance needs. So the question, so that Gentile was your Marufya, and the question is, was another Jew allowed to compete for your Marufya or not? So the classic example of Hasagat Gevul is if one Jew seeks to infringe on the monopoly relationship another Jew has over the business of this Gentile. So what's the law about Marufya? So if you look on the source sheet, this is starting in the second paragraph, the one labeled Shulchan Aruch, Koshin Mishpat, section 156. So we are 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, 8 lines down. It says, if a person has an idolater as a Marufya, so there are places where the courts will forbid others to descend into his livelihood to do business with that idolater. There are places where we will say, right, you can get an injunction. Right, if somebody tries to right, to do business with your, right, with your marufka, you can't stop him legally. There are places where the courts do not take marufka cases. You come in and you say, you know, so-and-so is trying to interfere with my business with Duke so-and-so, so what? There are places, right, some places permit another Jew to follow an idolater, to lend him, you know, or to solicit his business, and even to bribe him, and to take his business. I mean, they allow cutthroat competition, because they say that the assets of an idolater are treated as if they are ownerless, not meaning that you can steal them, but meaning that, right, that there is no notion of your having possession of their business. And some prohibit this. Now, I'm interested in the way in which this law is framed. Because you might think ordinarily that this is what we call a machloket, right? Meaning that some people say this is forbidden and some people say this is permitted. But that's not actually what it is. There's not a dispute ever about whether we enforce marufia. What there are, and the Shulchan Aruch's language is careful here, there are different geographic locations, some of which had the custom, right, the customary law, right, they treated it as law, but there was no conceptual dispute about whether the category Hasivat Vul applies to Marufya. There were decisions made in different places as to whether to do it. And that seems, I mean, if it's a moral issue, then, right, how can that be? It should be a matter of dispute. But it wasn't a matter of dispute. It was a matter in which we could simply tolerate different positions. And the most likely outcome of that, the most likely rationale for that is that these are simply different positions about what is the best form of economic regulation, likely in response to different circumstances. So for me, the economic calculus is as follows. And I think, I think that the issue is, if one Jew has already established an exclusive relationship with this idolater, so it is in the interest of the community for other Jews to seek to expand the number of Gentiles with whom Jews can do business. So it's a communal inefficiency for people to compete for the business when that business has already been obtained for the community. All you'll do is lower prices for the person outside your community without bringing any new thing in. So the economic interest of the community is to prevent competition. However, that only works, and we'll see this play out in a moment, that only works in an environment where there's no possibility of competition from non-Jews. Because if there's a possibility of competition from non-Jews, then the result of failing to have competition among Jews is that Jews will end up being inefficient and the business will go to non-Jews. So I would suggest that the difference between the places where they enforced marufia and the places where they don't is that they enforced marufia in places where they thought the market had not been saturated. There were still non-Jews who could be in relationship with Jews, but were not yet, but where there was no risk of competition from non-Jews. And they didn't enforce marufia in places where either the market was saturated or there was risk of competition from non-Jews, and then there were borderline places where the custom might be right. But I think the best way, this is the paradigmatic law of Hasagat Gvul. It's not a moral principle because it varies by geography. Nobody ever argues about what the law should be, and there's a perfectly good economic rationale. Now you do have a question, yes?
Why would they then insert the notion of Yifsei? What's the point of bringing that up?
Okay, so you're right that there are four positions of the Shulchan Aruch, and it's not clear how the first two and last two relate. That language seems to suggest that there is some kind of notion of priority, and I want to hold that for a moment. You're absolutely right. The question is that the language of the Shulchan Aruch in position three is that we have to say the reason we allow unfettered competition is because Gentile, right, because the assets of Gentiles are considered to be ownerless, which suggests that the assets of Jews are not considered ownerless, and we don't allow unfettered competition in those areas, which suggests that there is some kind of baseline regulation of competition that simply doesn't apply to the assets of non-Jews. Right, and that's a very good reading. Right, it's a very good reading. It's sort of a risk in my taking Shulchan Aruch as opposed to primary sources. I think we'll get back to it, but if not, it's an excellent reading. Prima facie. Yes?
Rabbi, so...
What's your name, by the way?
Mitchell. So, I mean, I don't know if this is a translation issue, but when you're talking about Gentiles, but they're using the term idolater.
Yeah, so the... In,
and should I think about that as like Christian versus Muslim, or...?
Okay, very good. So, in general, distinction, rabbinic texts from certainly the pre-20th century tend to replace the term Gentile with the term idolater whenever there is a distinction drawn between Jews and non-Jews, and then to claim that the Gentiles, whichever Gentile was reading this text, was not an idolater, and it didn't apply to them. And the problem is there are some laws that really do apply only to idolaters, but it's almost impossible to distinguish in the text which they are, because the texts are censored.
So think of idolater as basically synonymous with.
So, I think in this text, the law idolater was synonymous with Gentile, but as we'll talk about it, that also assumed a certain kind of relationship between the Jewish community and the Gentile community. So it doesn't mean that it applies to, that necessarily applies to all Gentiles in all time. Because there was a reason that all Gentiles were the equivalent of idolaters in that culture. Even though we wouldn't care particularly about what their theological beliefs were. And I'll try and make the argument as we go forward. Okay. Great questions all. Yes.
Just a comment that I would be curious about your reaction to, but it seems like this is all about like us against them, because in effect, it's basically saying, you know, if we have a monopoly right here with this idolater, let's leave it alone, right? I mean, because we're just, you know, we have a monopoly on the non-Jews, that's okay. But, like, there's nothing wrong with that morally, like, it just, because it's a non-Jew. But once it escapes from that area, then, you know, it's free competition and everybody can compete amongst the Jews.
Right, so I'll answer that question. It's really an extension of the answer to Mitchell's question, that yes, the presumption of all pre-modern texts is that the community, well, almost all, is that the community that we are interested in, whose economic interests we look out for, is the Jewish communities. And we're not interested in maximizing the universal good, we're interested in maximizing the economic good of the economic good of the Jewish community, and we might see it as a zero-sum game.
Right, all right. As opposed to many other ethical things, you can't kill a non-Jew.
Right, right. This is very... This is in business. We don't see any reason that Jews shouldn't get all the business. Okay. So what I've set up so far is a case for halachic competition law being about the regulation of competition, actually, right, on economic grounds as opposed to moral grounds. But then I wanted to point out that it's not possible to say that it's purely that. And the reason for that is if you take a look again at the Shulchan Aruch, so he says that this is the, right, section 156 is the law regarding one who descended into the profession of his fellow. All right, the law regarding, the term is yored lumnato shel chavero. So if you flip the page on the source sheet, you'll see that the Talmud Sanhedrin page 81a says that Rav Acha, the son of Rabbi Chanina, taught, and he quotes a verse in the prophets that has all sorts of hyperbolic statements about the good person is the one who doesn't do this, and he reinterprets all those statements. And one of the statements is the good person is somebody who has not slept adulterously with his neighbor's wife, and what that means is somebody who has not descended into the profession of his neighbor. So this category, descending into the profession of his neighbor, is explicitly turned into a category which is unrelated to economics, and this is not, right, it's not because, right, the reason to object to adultery is not because of, you know, some, it's not the optimal market regulation of marriage, right, it's a fundamental breach of a relationship, right, so therefore, presumably, right, the point being made in analogizing, descending in the profession of your friend to adultery is the claim that there is something intrinsically wrong in those cases. It's not an issue of economic efficiency, as you have done something wrong to somebody else. Furthermore, you have in the Talmud and Kedushin page 59a, in the midst of a really fascinating story, which perhaps we'll come back at some point and read up.
For sure.
Yes.
So the
It's interesting, though, that we take the notion of a Sabbath school, Yoridim Masul Chadero, as a halachic value or a transgression almost, and yet every other case in that Gemara is much more of a Gadic. If you look at the Gemara per se,
yes,
you would assume it's a Gadic Gemara. You would not assume there's a halachic.
No, that's my whole point.
A halachic force to it, as opposed to specifically this case of a Sabbath school where Yoridim Masul Chadero actually has a halachic, very strong halachic component.
So I think we should distinguish, you know, I think the words halachic and agadic are complicated in that context. They're all things that are usur, but not usually things that are enforceable. Yeah, okay, right. That one, that was explained. Okay, good.
It's a nice idea to be humble,
okay,
but that's not
fair.
I'm not sure there's a transgression there.
Okay, fair. So I think, I guess what I would say is, to me it means that term has a moral valence, right? And therefore it's hard for me to believe that the whole category in the Shulchan Aruch, and this is not the only one, by the way, it's also compared to murder somewhere else. Right? It's very hard for me to imagine it doesn't have a moral valence, and that lends a tinge to the other laws. Talmud Kedushin says, in the midst, again, of a fascinating story, when he went, he found him, and he said, if a poor person is chasing a cake and somebody comes and takes it from him, what is the law? And he said to him, he's called wicked, because he descended l'chayei chaveru, into the living of his fellow. Now that is a case that is set up to make, right, to create moral feeling. Poor person chasing something, and you walk in and you grab it just before he does. Now the legal ramifications of that case are very complicated. It occurs in the context of a story in which nobody's poor. But the presumption is that everyone has an inherent recognition that it's wrong to steal candy from babies. Right? And it's wrong to yank cakes away from poor people. So the extent to which the halachot of us, right, and it uses the same term, descending into the living of his fellow, right? Instead of onud, it says chayim, but that shows up in a couple of cases. So I think that it's very, very hard to argue that it isn't the moral component, the halacha in this regard. So we have to try and find a way to, right, to say, right, to figure out where and when we're talking economics and where and we're talking morals. Are, right, to what extent those function independently or they function together, whether there are trade-offs, how they adjust socially, right, those are the real questions we have to ask. Yes, then. Okay. So now, but I want to challenge the dichotomy a different way, because what I've done so far is really fall into the same trap as the standard presentation. But I set it up and I said, well, the question is halakha about regulating competition, for market purposes, or is halakha about moral issues? Well, that assumes that economic regulation is not a moral issue. But who says that's so? Right, every economic regulation makes decisions, right? For example, non-Jews versus Jews. Right, that's a moral decision. If you regulate the market in such a way that you maximize the economic interests of Jews, Even though that creates a parallel disadvantage for non-Jews, so you're making a moral decision. And all economic regulations make decisions over who should be the winners and losers. Right, there isn't such a thing, I would contend, right? I think most of the colleagues acknowledge there isn't such a thing as a completely neutral regulation. So really the dichotomy was false in the first place. We have to figure out, right, all economic regulations, once we acknowledge that halakha is involved in market regulation for economic purposes, we have to try and figure out what the moral issues involved in that are.
Well, both the examples in Sanhedrin and Kedushin apply to cases where Gentiles are not involved, so it's Jew on Jew.
We don't know, they don't mention
it. Well, first of all, there's no adultery with a non-Jew. The laws of adultery do not apply.
If the laws of adultery, I would suggest apply to the wife of a non-Jew. If you're a Jewish male, we treat the other way around for the purposes of mamzerut. We don't treat male non-Jew with Jewish
women. There was no kedushin.
Nonetheless, I think that halakha is that we recognize marital bonds among non-Jews halakhically, and so for a Jew to sleep with a non-Jew's wife is adultery, right? Is a violation of adultery. That's what I would contend. So I'm not sure I'm willing to accept your premise. Okay, I'm not sure I'm willing to accept your premise. Enoch and Adam, right, you what? You want to set up as a president, maybe the moral issues only occur among Jews and don't occur between Jews and non-Jews. Right? That's,
well, that's how I see it, with these two examples.
Okay, let's take that as a, as put it in the same box, right, as David, right?
Joshua.
Yeah, Joshua, sorry, I got it wrong. Yes, no, no, I get it. Sorry, no, I have the last name too. Again, right, said, I think we'll put it in the same box, so I'm going to try and address that in a few lines. Okay, so I want to set up what I think is a classic medieval dispute. You can find some echoes of it in the Shulchan Aruch and talk about how that would play out. So if you look back in on the page of Shulchan Aruch, you look after it says in rule number 7, right, this is what Ivan quoted earlier, merchants who bring their merchandise to sell within the cities, the citizens of the city to which they're bringing the merchandise can prevent them from selling retail in the manner of shopkeepers. Right, so you if you are an importer, and your ship, right, and your ship docks with its load of toys, this load of Star Wars figurines, and lots of local people already have shops selling their Star Wars figurines, so you can sell it to the local merchants, right, wholesale, so they can resell it retail, but you cannot open your own store to sell your Star Wars figurines retail, right, unless they permit you. No, if you have, no, it's not a limitation on the retail merchant in the store. It's an external merchant who brings their goods, right, has to sell through the local merchants. Right, you cannot go into competition with the local merchants just because you brought in new goods.
And what is preventing?
They can get an injunction from the rabbinic court stating that you are stopped from engaging in retail trade. If you try and do it, they'll confiscate your goods. Okay.
Is this a guild model?
Guilds are about the crafty manufacturer yourself, right? So here we're talking about commerce, right? There is a guild model, but I tend to treat that more in the context of labor relations than in the context of commerce. And one of the things we're not going to talk about tonight is what the boundary is between commercial law and craft law in halakha. Yes.
Just to get back to his question. So let's say you're a local person, but you have a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
Can you start selling Star Wars figurines?
So that's a good question, and that the shorthand answer. So if I had given the standard share about how Jewish law regulates competition, we would have started off by pointing out that there seems to be a Talmudish debate which says that it depends on local geographic monopolies, and it depends whether you're in the same courtyard, the same alleyway, the same section of the city, whether you pay taxes in the same section. That would be the short answer.
But whatever it is, in other words, is local, however you define the local area, who was in a different business and now goes into this business, is he then still okay because he was local, or is he similar to the outsider who came in because he's going into some unrelated business? Right.
So the short but incomplete answer is he's not like the outsider because he is part of the same economic unit as you are. But that's oversimplified because there are cases where that will not be true. But for my purposes, it's better to say he's more like the inside. Okay? But I'm telling you up front, but it would be a wholly different share to try and parse the differences. It's the right question, I just I can't do it now. Yes?
This might be more unrelated, but something that currently may be the outsider is not contributing, not resident, they're not contributing to the community in terms of taxes and things. So maybe kind of
excellent. About to get there.
So we're like amateur.
We're just about to get there. Okay, exactly
that. That would justify the distinction.
So if you look at the seven, so the Shulchan Aruch, Rav Yosef Karo, sets this up as the law. Then the Ramah, Rav Moshe Israelis, in his glosses, says that some say the rule that citizens of the city can protest against allowing the citizens of other cities to sell applies only when there is no loss to consumers. Meaning that the outside sellers sell at the same price as the locals, and their merchandise is no better than that of the locals. But if they sell cheaper or better quality, So the consumers benefit from them, the local merchants cannot protest. Now that's a pretty radical limitation. Right? It's the only time in which you can prevent the competition is if the competition will provide absolutely no value to consumers. That is the position of Rav Yosef Ibn Migash. Right? The Ibn Migash says that, right, and what it essentially does is it eviscerates all restrictions on the competition.
They're not going to be that interested in protesting in that case.
Pardon?
They're not going to be that interested in protesting in that case because people aren't going to be that motivated to switch.
That's right. And put it this way, and as the Ramban immediately points out, hang on a sec, this is impossible. Competition always lowers prices. So how could you possibly have such a case? So the Ramban says the Ibn Migash must be wrong. Because if this were the case, then the Talmud would never have such regulations. Because it would never exist. So the Ramban says that in fact it applies even if they are offering a cheaper price, but the Ramban says what should happen in that case is that the local court should compel the locals to sell at the price that the outsiders would have sold at. Right? And that's his attempt. He says that's his attempt to guard against price gouging. Right? So we get the benefits of competition without actual competition. Now the problem with this, of course, is that people knowing that that's the only response will not bother showing up in the first place. Right? So this is not very good economic regulation. Right? But his attack on the Ibn Migash is a very good attack. So now what to me is a really interesting test case, because here the Namukhe Yosef disagrees with the Ramban. None of these sources aren't on the sheet, I apologize. Namukhe Yosef disagrees with the Ramban. And as I understand the Namukhe Yosef and Ramban, here's what happens among them. They come up with a really interesting test case. What happens if the outsiders are going to sell cheaper, but it's because they have an inherent price advantage, an inherent cost advantage. And there are two ways that can happen. So one way, which is what you suggested, I'm sorry, what was your name?
Isaac.
Yeah. So what Isaac suggested is that fundamentally, outsiders don't pay local taxes. So if you come from from India, you come from a place you're in the same area, you just don't pay local taxes, you have an advantage. And the second thing is, what happens if you have an intrinsic cost advantage because you're coming from a place where labor is cheaper? Right, so how do these halakhot apply? Right, assuming that we recognize that there is the Ibn Migash who says you can't allow a loss to consumers, and the Ramban who thinks you can prevent the loss to consumers. So here we have a case where we acknowledge there is no way to keep out outside competition without causing a loss to consumers. So one way of framing it is, so this is unfair competition. They have a built-in cost advantage, and this is when you should engage in protectionism. And we create a high tariff state. And if you want to compete, we're going to tax you until your prices are the same as the locals. The other possibility is, I think, what's classically called mercantilism, right? Let's set up no tariffs, and let's have the maximal consumer. There's no reason; it makes no sense to prop up the local businesses since they're not survivable in the long run. Eventually, the barriers will come down. And there's an intermediate position, right, which we're still arguing about, right? Is there a point at which, right, in the infancy of particular industries, right, or a particular kind of political condition, that it makes sense to engage in protectionism in the short term until the industry can become competitive? And this is still a debate we have going on in the United States now. It happens in the machlokes between the Ramban and the Namukhe Yosef. Right, so the Ramban would say that in such circumstances you keep out the outside produce because they have an unfair advantage, and your job is to protect your local people. And Namukhe Yosef says you're protecting the interests of the producers against the interests of the consumers.
So the unfairness is just based on the status status quo effectively of the village.
Yeah.
It's defined by the status quo.
Yeah, but it's the United States and right, Mexico or China, right, when labor costs are lower. And you have exactly the same debates, and that debate happens to be as... But what I like is really the way it's framed in the Mukiyose is what...
You're dealing with externalities also.
Yes.
I mean, that, which is a layer which is much more complicated, especially in the old days.
Right, I'm interested, you know, in the way that they analyze it. And where the language of the Mukiyose that really interests me is, why do you identify yourself with the interests of the producers instead of the interests of the consumers? Because that brings home the recognition that you're making moral choices when you regulate markets. Well, entirely different here if we were doing employment law. So you will see, I think.
Well, that's what I'm saying, is that I don't think it's necessarily the case, because obviously, let's just say there's no pollution in this town because all the merchants abide by certain...
Inoconomic, right? You could try and find a way... You can claim Mukiyose's analysis is oversimplified. I'm fine with that. But the way he frames it is that way. My usual, if I'm doing employment law, you would see that I would argue that Rav Moshe Feinstein has many, many tshuvot defending labor rights. Halacha for the last 25 years has been much more about protecting, right? Much more, we become a community that is much more worried about the ravages of teachers' unions than about protecting protecting teachers. And the reason is Rav Moshe Feinstein, in Rav Moshe Feinstein's time, the Orthodox community was blue collar. And so his constituency, right, was blue-collar workers. And that's whom he identified with. And then we got to be white-collar, upper-class suburbanites. And so now the constituency of the rabbis making decisions is upper-middle-class suburbanites. And right, and the interest of halacha shifts accordingly. We might argue, right, I would argue that so far that's been an unconscious moral choice. It would be much better if we articulated that there are moral choices being made, and perhaps there would be some kind of corrective, because I don't think that's what halakha should be. Okay, yes?
Isn't there always a difference between wholesale and retail pricing, and even within the local market, you're going to have differences, you know, it always operates that way.
So it would take us many, and I apologize, it would take us many more than one year to try and really fully parse halakhic economics. For example, the Mishnah after the one about distributing chestnuts says that is the question of whether it's legal to undercut the market price. That implies the existence of a market price. Now, what is a market price in the absence of an explicit regulatory authority? So Ramban says that the Beit Din is the local regulatory authority, but not everyone agrees that the Beit Din has the default setting is the Beit Din regulates all prices. Right? They seem to be working with the notion that there is such a thing as a fixed, determinable market price in every area. That's also how you can talk about, you know, about overcharging, all sorts of things like that. I think that that's a whole separate field.
My point here is that it seems to be emphasizing that these are wholesalers coming from outside who want to act like retailers, who want to sell, you know, yad al yad,
yeah.
Which I'm saying is that it's not really necessarily a situation of people coming from different locations. That's always, you have a parallel, you have two different
right, so I think that, right. So I think that's Dieber Behove, right?
You have wholesalers selling at retail prices.
Right, so I think that's Dieber Behove, that was their usual market, right, is that you imported wholesale and you sold retail. Right, you could complicate it in cases where there are locally produced goods as well, and there are people, locals, who wholesale local goods. What if the outsiders try and compete with the wholesalers? I think that would be the same thing. I don't think retail specifically, although there are other contexts where retail does matter, because they recognize that that they never stop people from selling in the market, and the reason for that presumably is that establishing a market is good for everyone's economy. This, by the way, right, for example, the thing that keeps showing up is that the presumption, the way in which most naive interpreters of halakha asakah gvul is that you want to keep that by keeping out competitors, you preserve one person's interest. But the classic asakah gvul case in America was Teaneck fast food, and it becomes the classic case to recognize that actually two kosher restaurants in an area do better than one, both do, because they attract the clientele, and so actually often you harm people's business, but there are cases where encouraging competition is not only good for consumers, it's good for everybody, because you need to create a critical mass.
Is that generally true, though?
Yeah.
So that's what Professor Gaynor and Professor Rosenbaum...
There's restaurants in the Upper West Side. I'm not sure they would all be doing so well.
So Professor Gaynor and Professor Rosenbaum are trying to work on an article, right, of what, right, which would allow Batei Din to have access to reasonably useful economic formula that would enable them to tell whether preventing competition would be, right, as opposed to just handling it with a blunt instrument, because right now people just guess. Right? I've been in these conversations. Well, what do you think will happen? Oh,
even
I think we've got a business.
They just guess.
Pardon?
Even with the formulas, they just guess.
It doesn't matter whether that will work or not. I haven't seen the production. That's what they do. That's what they do professionally. So I'm hoping, you know, I'm hopeful it will be. That's what the case my students wrote about this summer was about a shul thrift shop with a chain thrift shop moving in. Right? And what do we think the impact of the chain thrift shop moving in will be on the, right? So it might be that it becomes a destination for thrift shoppers. Right? I know myself, right? I like being in areas where there are lots of thrift shops. Or it might be that because it has efficiency of scale, that it will wipe out the synagogue market. Do they have niche markets? Right? All those sorts of questions. There's the whole question, you know, where the what happens if the everyone agrees, it's in the Shulchan Aruch, that if they sell different merchandise, there are none of these restrictions apply. But what defines merchandise is different? Right? Is it because I painted the thing pink instead of blue, so now it's in the girls' toys department, so the boys' toys department? Right? If I make a bobblehead doll, right, you know, an eighth of an inch taller, is that different? You have to define what constitutes a market. And we have another, yes.
The market is dynamic, certainly, mm-hmm. as we understand it. And so, halacha today, I know, for example, in places like Borough Park, where you have dairy restaurants opening up across the street from each other. And the main argument, I thought it was truly an example of Azagaz Gvul, but I actually spoke to the proprietor, and he said, well, the population is wrong. There is a flow of lots of Jews who eat only this kind of food, and so there's a need. Now, the question is, did the posek there determine, based on some demographic, that it's truly needed or not? So I think these two professors clearly should come up with some kind of...
Right, now this form. Is a... What I want to get is, right, that there, you know, that the law is interested, right? There is no... right. The halakha is...
Ultimately, it rests on the basis of the restaurant, because that's how the Beis Din needs to understand it. That doctrine is the prevailing doctrine.
But that doctrine is kind of vague.
It's vague. Of course it's vague.
It sounds like you're trying to guess how big the smartphone market is before smartphones existed.
So, okay. So what I'm going to do is...
It's like false precision.
Yes. So I think that's fair, right? So, okay. I want to take... I want to try and finish by 9:10, so I'm going to try and do the transition into modernity. I hope that this just gives you the beginnings of what I think would be a much more sophisticated presentation than what usually happens, which is we just sort of assume that halakha protects the status quo under all circumstances, and the reason it does is because we always need to protect the existing person, and we don't have considerations, right, broader societal considerations. So one issue in terms of translation to modernity, obviously, is how this relates to a society where we don't control the economy. Right, so the classical economic sources deal with the case either where you entirely control the society, or where you have an internal society and external society and they don't mix. So what happens if you live in a pluralistic society? So we have first two sets of questions. So the first one is, which we already saw in the case of the Marupya, is that it makes no sense to impose regulations on Jews in an open market which non-Jews can participate in, unless you think the non-Jews are bound by the same principles. So this exists both in theory and in practice. In practice, obviously, it is ridiculous to impose competition restrictions on Jews when the result of imposing competition restrictions on non-Jews is that a non-Jew will get the market. Right? To say, you can't compete with his grocery store because that's a violation of Azagaz Gvul, even though you know that tomorrow Walmart's going to come in and wipe him out if you don't, right, create a more efficient thing, that's ridiculous. That's already said very explicitly by the Maharshal. Right? In the 16th century, it just said, all this just goes out the window if there's the possibility of a non-Jewish competitor. And the second question is, theoretically, let's suppose that the state of Israel decided to be halachic and it regulates both Jews and non-Jews. Do we think that non-Jews would be bound by this law? So you have an effort by Rav Moshe Isserles in his response in number 10 to try and argue that this is a subset of the laws of robbery, and that non-Jews are bound by them also, so that actually this is theoretically an ideal system that would bind both Jews and non-Jews, even the moral components, but it's a very, very weak argument. I tend to think that what we would take, even to make contributions in theory, in general, when we're trying to translate things to America from Jewish tradition, so it doesn't make sense to translate distinctions that separate between the interests of Jews and non-Jews in the American context and try and make moral claims. Right? You recognize this very simply whenever you try and say, okay, what is the Orthodox Jewish attitude towards abortion restrictions? And so your good halachas will get up and say, well, our attitude is that abortion should be permitted for Jews to preserve, right, in certain cases, but for non-Jews in a different set of cases, and obviously that is not a recommendation for American legislation. Right? Nothing in halakha that distinguishes between Jews and non-Jews will make any kind of contribution to American society. So I think the only way to make Hasagat Gvul relevant to a conversation about what America should be doing economically is to assume that we replace the model. We say that the model that halakha in the past had of Jews and non-Jews was assuming that the non-Jewish community saw its interests as opposed. But when you see yourself as part of the same community, so then all of us are the insiders, and what we want for America is the same thing that we used to want within the Jewish community, and possibly will relate to Mexico the same way we related to non-Jews in the past. Otherwise, we say nothing useful at all. A second issue, which I think is a challenge in modernity, is that most of the classical halakha doesn't really have a model of technological progress. And so restriction on competition was only seen as having immediate term context, right? What are the immediate term economic impacts? We didn't think about what the long term context is. So Rav Asher Weiss, who is a tremendous posek in Eretz Yisrael, has a long tshuva in which he says, so you're telling me that because of Hasagat Gvul, we're going to prevent horseless carriages, right? Because if we allow horseless carriages to enter into the market, then all the people who sell horses are going to be, right? And that can't be. Right, it has to be that we recognize technological progress as a value, and we're going to have to find a way to allow to say that halakha in no way restricts competition if that competition is for the societal good in the long term, and that means also, for example, which we've been trying for 500 years now to develop copyright law, which may or may not be a good idea. We don't have the beginnings of patent law. Now, if you're talking the classic model of competition regulation in America, right? So copyright and patent are the classic cases. So copyright we had interest in, because we produce lots of books. But patents are really a product of the Industrial Revolution. And before that, you didn't really have that rapid enough technological progress that it would be such a deal, although it might be circular. So those are areas where, in order to try and figure out what it would be like to translate halakha into modernity, so really the categories, intellectual property is the primary area really where we have to consider these issues, and we haven't. So you have to recognize we have an enormous amount of work to do. Two more points. I want to point out that it's always difficult to talk about the Jewish approach to an abstract issue because unless there's a really effective live tradition, because otherwise you have a multivocal tradition, and if you analyze the classical disputes conceptually, you can come out at opposite extremes. And certainly there are fundamental disputes, where we go back to your question. Right, so do we say, do we impose restrictions? There's one position in the Talmud, the position of Rabbah, which says that you can always prevent competition in your local area. And there's a competing position by Rabbah Bar Rahuna, which says you can only prevent competition under a fairly narrowly defined set of circumstances. Which of those two positions do we adopt? Right? Generally, the first position has been taken as an extreme protectionist position, and the second position has been taken as an extreme free market position. You have the dispute we mentioned in the Mishnah about whether we have restrictions on competition by giving out candy. Right? We have a dispute between Rashi and Avinatam as to whether the poor person chasing the cake, whether that model applies to all kinds of transactions, or only to transactions where the second party doesn't have access to a similar cake somewhere else. But where the party does have access, but Rabbeinu Tam takes the position that if there's a poor person running after a cake, and I'm rich, but you know what? I like coffee cakes. That's a coffee cake. My bodega is out of coffee cakes. Well, I can just go grab the cake away from him. And similarly, in terms of jobs, right? If there's a poor person going for a job, and I want the same job, as long as I don't have another, right? Even though I'm doing okay, and he's impoverished, I can just take his, I can just take the job. So that Rabbi Natam, you know, open, if you understand Rabbi Natam that way, then there are almost no restrictions. Whereas Rashi, who says it applies to all transactions, can be read as saying that whenever somebody else is even doesn't even have it yet, they're just in the process of obtaining something, you always give them priority. The way in which this translates most sharply into contemporary America is there is a claim that Rabbi Soloveitchik said once when asked, there is no concept of Hasagat Gvul in America. That you haven't read, the laws just don't apply. He didn't explain why. Even assuming you accept the report, I believe Rabbi Yossi Adler says that he heard it, but that he never got the Rav to explain it. So there are all sorts of ways of doing it. One way of explaining what Rabbi Yossi meant is that Halakha tried to regulate competition in a market that was already heavily regulated, and so you had to counter it to create fairness. Right, to create fairness for Jews, but America is already a perfectly regulated market. We're not going to do any better. So why should we even bother entering it? So there's no moral element at all. On the other hand, if you read the response of Rav Moshe Feinstein, so Rav Moshe Feinstein goes so far as to, when he's asked by, and this was an object lesson, there was a synagogue in Flatbush that was getting overcrowded. So they wanted to expand. But they were afraid that during the period, because they would have to close for the period they were expanding, or at least shrink their thing. They were afraid that during that period, somebody else would build a new synagogue, and so they would spend all the money on the expansion, and they would not have enough members to pay for it. So Rav Moshe gave them a prior injunction, saying that he hereby rules that nobody is allowed to build a synagogue in Flatbush within a 10-block radius for the next 10 years or something like that. There's no record of exactly what happened, but it seems unlikely that that is really what happened, you know, since Flatbush kind of exploded right after, virtually right after that Shiva. But you can see Rav Moshe constantly regulates on the ground of the Sagavuli. There's a very, very strong notion of tenure, both in labor and in commerce. And so you have Rabbi Soloveitchik, Rav Moshe Feinstein, really with radically opposed visions of what this halakhic framework is supposed to be like in America. Yes, Rabbi Sharon. So I think we're still playing it out. Yes, Dan.
You mentioned the question about technological advancement resulting in competition. I think in Roshon Kluger's tshuva about machine matzahs, one of his points about position about kashering machine matzahs is that it's going to put the hand matzah bakers out of
business. Yeah, many people, right? Many people said that, right? That and in particular, now it's kind of more complicated because hand matzah bakeries only work one month a year. And so this was actually employment specifically for yeshiva students who could make a decent living for 1 month a year. And we skipped the parts where the Talmud says that all these restrict regulations and competition don't apply to scholars. But if a scholar comes to market, right, comes in as a wholesaler, then you let him sell out before anyone local is allowed to sell because we're really interested in supporting scholars, but that assumes a regimen where we don't pay scholars any salaries, so we have to provide market opportunities for them, right? But that just shows clearly, right, that there has to be, right, that you're prioritizing whenever you engage in economic regulation. I should end with a broad statement. What I'm trying to set up here is a model, right? The way in which I think the standard halakhic presentation has been, and probably will be until my students dominate the world, is that people present the halakha as it is, on the assumption that halakha as it is really, really good, and other people should learn from it. What I want to suggest is that in the contemporary world, there are lots of areas where the halakha isn't. Right? We don't really have a halakha, and in order to develop the halakha, we're going to have to learn from lots of things. Now, that doesn't mean that there is, right? We want to develop the system organically because ultimately we want to build a Torah that is capable of organizing a society, And if we abandon the whole economic sphere and say Torah has nothing to do about this, so then we're going to have less and less to say about the real world. But we should be very careful about claiming that we already have the answers. We should say that we should be engaged in the process of creating this, and we try and do that authentically, but also the recognition that we have a great deal to learn practically and about the experience of others, in constructing such a system. So in this area, certainly, as I've tried to show, we have lots to learn from economics. We have a whole bunch, a whole lot of reality to catch up on. I think that we, as in many areas, it's not at all clear to me that it's a good idea to try and create piecemeal halakha. So for example, let's suppose that we say, this is what happens most of the time. The only place where people try to actually make these laws are when things are internal to the Jewish community. So the only area where Haskagul ever comes up is kosher pizza shops. Because that's the only place where you control the whole market. Every other case, it's silly to regulate because otherwise a non-Jew will just come in. Right? So this, you have to be able to control market entry in order to make regulation pay. So now imagine that you have a store, and the store has a kosher side and a non-kosher side, and the owner is an Orthodox Jew, so they ask you a shaila, and they say, well, on your kosher side, right, you can only compete this way, and it would be terribly wrong of you to compete any other way. But on the non-kosher side, we want you to engage in the most cutthroat competition there is, because they're right. So that's not a way for people to live. Right? That's an experientially terrible way to paskin for people, because it makes halakha seem like it has nothing real to say. So I think we need to construct halakha that's like a kibbol that is capable of letting people live in the integrated economy that we actually live in. And that is true in many areas of economic halakha, as I said earlier at Minta, right, really the whole purpose of halakha nowadays is to find a way to make halakha irrelevant. Right? That's what Dan said talking about, I gave an example of your day, which is a bad idea, but where you have many, many hours spent, right, trying to make the laws of charging interest to Jews relevant by tightening the contract that enables you to evade the law and charge interest. And I think that is, under some circumstances, it's the best we can do, but it's a loss, right? Because if you do it well, right, you achieve irrelevance, and we can eventually end up, where the system would say, well, the best way to live as an Orthodox Jew is to live on Mars, according to the position that the Torah only applies on Earth. Now you're perfectly halakhic, and you can study it all, but it has no relevance whatsoever in your life. All right, there is such a position. I think you can find it in Rabbi Lam's spectacular article on, on how the Torah will react to the discovery of intelligent extraterrestrial life. Which I highly recommend, should you be interested in the topic. I always say it's one of Rabbi Lam's enduring virtues, that he can discuss any topic without being silly. And no one since has ever, if you look at the discussion, no one has since ever even tried to do anything other than see Rabbi Lam's article on the subject. But I want to emphasize what I'm doing here. Well, I talked about Hasagat Gvul, but I'm really talking about there are many, many areas of halakha right now where what we're doing is simply making our terms for the relevance and then pretending that we're studying it for real, when actually what we need to do is sometimes start over, or at least start from first principles and see whether we could say something, recognizing that we may not be able to enforce it for quite some time. And the only way to make it relevant is to get people to voluntarily choose to enter such a system, and acknowledging that right now we need the way in which to rebuild economic halakha is to try and find a way to create a viable system that people want to be part of, as opposed to creating a coercive system that people only find ways to work around. All right, Beth, thank you very, very much for listening.
Thank you, Rabbi Clapper. Thank you very much.
Do you think there's an issue with that sometimes? Oh. Distinguishing
that. One last thing. If those of you who were here enjoyed it and are not currently signed up for my weekly Dvar Torah, then please go to TorahLeadership.org or find the Center for Modern Torah Leadership on Facebook and sign up for the Dvar Torah, and that way you can...